Well, I need to start by thanking Pastor Frank for preaching for me last week. We had a wedding in my backyard. It was my daughter's wedding, and I want to show you just a few pictures of that wedding. It was in the backyard under a big oak tree in our backyard, and it was hot. Do you remember it was hot last week? So hot. That sign in the oak tree, Keith made it. It is Persian, and that's my daughter's new last name, Inayat. My son-in-law's family is from Afghanistan. The officiant, I want to show you the officiant. That's my brother. You may not have met him because he's a pastor, and so when he has a Sunday off, he doesn't go to church. But that's my brother. His name is Daryl, like my father's name is Daryl. It really was a wonderful, wonderful wedding. I think it was exactly what the bride and groom wanted. It was exactly what the mother of the bride wanted. But you know what I didn't know? It's exhausting. It's exhausting to have a child get married. It wore me out. So thank you for your patience with me this week. We are in the book of Exodus, chapter 17. It was a short passage that Blake read for us this morning. Exodus chapter 17 is a story of God's incredible provision. There is no water for the Israelites, none. They are in the desert, and God provides water. That is the simplest way to sum up the story, and it is a very true way to sum up this story in Exodus chapter 17. But I want you to know there's more than that. There is more than that to this very short passage, because this short passage is about people. What happens to people when we freely wander away from our captors toward the promised land? When we do that, there are a few hiccups, and this is one of those hiccups. The Israelites are in the desert of Zin, and they reach Rephidim, which is a rest stop. Rephidim literally means rest stop. So this is a place or a station in the freedom wandering. Now, scholars do not agree on exactly where Rephidim would be located on a map. It's just somewhere out there. Somewhere out there in the desert, the people stop, and there is no water, and this is a really big problem. The course of action that the people choose is to quarrel with Moses, to complain, or to argue, or to take him to task. Give us water to drink, they demand. Moses is not patient. He is not. He's not understanding. He's not sympathetic. And this is a bit of a surprise to me. I expect Moses to be a good shepherd. He's irritated, and he's snippy. He says, "Why do you quarrel with me?" With some offense. And then Moses chooses to escalate things even further. So far, this has been a dispute between the leader and their people, but Moses chooses to make it bigger, to bring God into this. He says, "Why do you put the Lord to the test?" And of course, this makes the people grumble some more, because Moses' accusation stings. The people up the ante again. They say, "Well, why did you bring us out of Egypt so that we could die of thirst in the desert?" Moses then turns to God with some desperation. "What am I going to do with these people? They are ready to stone me." This dialogue is brief, but it's worth detailing because, you see, I believe that similar quarrels happen in deserts, in living rooms, in offices, everywhere. One person starts with a valid complaint, and then offense and fear get into the mix. The heat of the argument gets ratcheted up and up and up, and then perspective is lost, and relationship is broken. The need then becomes the miraculous intervention of God, the divine hand. Not too long ago, I watched a series on Netflix, and I did it like you sometimes do in Netflix, just watching one episode after the other. This series starred Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy. I bet you watched it too. It was a pretty popular series. They were married in this series, and there was a scene between the two of them where they were sleep deprived, and the topic at hand in that scene was little irritants in a marriage. Just little irritants. She said, little irritants I want to talk about. Like, for instance, I drink too much tea sometimes, and I'm inclined to get nervous. He said, oh, tea, is it? I would say, you're defensive and a tad paranoid. She replied, why do you speak to me in a condescending father tone? I wish you could hear yourself talk, but you never do. You act like a child. And he said, I act like a child. I need to get out of here and get some air. And then as the door slams, Moira Rose calls out, and you never finish your fights. We all have it in us, don't we? We all have it in us to act like sleep-deprived, selfish children. We all have it in us to let fear and self-preservation get the best of us. We do. I think it is why Moses renames Rephidim in Exodus chapter 17. He renames this place of the Israelites wandering, not God gave us what we needed, or God always provides, but Moses renames this place, this stop, testing and quarreling. That's what he renames this place, testing and quarreling, Massa and Meribah. And it is a place in the journey of faith for all of us. And we need to be on the lookout for it. Massa and Meribah gets mentioned other times in the Bible. It's not only in Exodus chapter 17, but it's in three of the Psalms. Psalm 81, Psalm 95, and Psalm 106. And it's also mentioned in Deuteronomy. Psalm 95, verse 8 says this, don't harden your hearts like you did at Meribah, like you did when you were at Massa in the wilderness. Don't harden your hearts? Don't harden your hearts, really? That's what Pharaoh does. Pharaoh is the one who has a hardened heart. Are you telling me, the Psalms are telling me, that the people of God are susceptible to this callousing of the heart? It's a bit of a surprise. It's a bit of a surprise that I should be on guard against a spiritual degradation that makes me look an awful lot like the worst of the worst in the Bible. It can happen to me too. I was sharing with my spiritual director recently what I observe in myself as a tendency towards pessimism when things are difficult. That my heart can stall out on things are bad and they're never going to get better. Here I am stuck out in this desert and I'm going to die of thirst. And my spiritual director was really quick to change my label. To change my label from I'm a pessimist to I'm in pain. She said, let's call it suffering and put your attention on compassion for the pain that you're experiencing. The new Happy website this week had a daily devotional. They do visual daily devotionals that addresses what to do when you're in pain. How do you lessen the pain? When you're in pain, being cruel to yourself makes the pain larger. That being kind to yourself lessens the pain. It's like when you're in pain, it's like getting struck by a dart from out of nowhere, and then you hit yourself with a second dart. It's a Buddhist proverb, actually, the proverb of two darts. From out of nowhere, you're hit by a dart, and then your response is just to hit yourself again with a second dart. It doesn't have to be that way. Kindness always lessens suffering, but being down on myself or cruel to myself ratchets up suffering, ratchets up disease and disconnection. So my spiritual director gave me this practice. There are four steps to the practice. The first is just notice that you're in pain. The second is relax, take a breath. The third is pay attention to what's happening around you. And then the fourth step is do something about it. Figure out what to do. These four steps are much better than blaming myself or blaming someone else or running away, just going back to Egypt, right? Notice you're in pain, relax, take a breath, pay attention to what's happening around you, and then figure out what to do about it. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said that sometimes groups of people suffer. Sometimes groups of people are in pain together. And he taught that when a group or a nation or a culture suffers, the easy focus becomes, who did this to us? Who can we blame? And that is a very dangerous and simplistic move to make, to place blame. The harder, the more difficult, and the more productive question that leads to spiritual growth is, what should we do? What should we do about the pain? And that is the question. That's the question that Moses asks God with some degree of desperation. Moses cries out to God, what am I to do? What am I to do with these people? And God sends Moses out in front of the Israelites. And this is a risky move. Bible scholar Robert Alter says that God basically sends Moses to take a beating because the people have become so angry and so hostile. God says, Moses, go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders and take that staff, the one that you struck the Nile with to unleash divine power. Go, strike the rock, and water will flow from the rock. You see, here's what I believe. In every age, in every group, people of courage are needed. In the model of Moses, those who will set their own self-interest aside and trust that God will provide. And trust that water will flow from the rock. We've misunderstood this. We have thought that what a group needs is just people to stand up for their own convictions, to loudly shout what they believe and what they think. But you see, in a community of faith, it's not what we think that is most important, it's relationship. It's relationship. What is needed is people to hold the anxiety and to trust that God will provide, as God always provides and sustains and recreates us. This is the water that flows from the rock for the people of God. You see, I do aspire to be this kind of leader. Sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I don't. But yesterday, when I was considering our congregation and this kind of leader, quickly 10 or 12 of your names came to my mind that you serve in formal and informal roles of leadership in this congregation in non-anxious ways. Spring Creek is very blessed because we have people. We have leaders who don't mind holding on to anxiety and waiting for the presence of the Holy Spirit to arrive. There is another story of water coming from a rock during the Israelites' journey to the Promised Land. It happens later in their journey, and it's in another location. So the story that you heard from Exodus chapter 17 is at the beginning of their wandering in the wilderness. But there's another story that happens at the very end of their wandering in the wilderness, and it's found in Numbers chapter 20. And rabbis taught that because this water rock shows up at the beginning of their journey and at the end of the 40 years of wandering, it was there with the people the whole time. They carried it with them like a portable water fountain. They always had water from the rock. The Apostle Paul must have known of this teaching when he wrote to the community at Corinth, because in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he wrote this: "I don't want you to be unaware. Our ancestors passed through the sea. They drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ." It's no surprise to me that Paul knew about the water flowing rock in the wilderness. It's no surprise to me either that Paul had faith in God's provision, and that Paul most clearly saw that grace in Jesus the Christ. Is the Lord among us or not? That's what the people demand. Is the Lord among us or not? And I would tell you, Spring Creek, the Lord most definitely is among us. We live our days with a trust that God will sustain us and God will restore us in unimaginable ways, in ways that we can't even predict, like water from a dry rock, a water rock that is always, always on hand for the people of faith. Amen.